coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly. Thank you for joining us again for another Worth Doing Badly. This week we will look at the lessons for the fifth Sunday in Lent. The readings are Isaiah 43 verses 16 through 21, the Psalm is 126, the epistle lesson is Paul's letter to the Philippians, the third chapter, verses 8 through 14, and the gospel lesson is from the account of the good news of Jesus Christ according to Luke 20 verses 9 through 20. And here's David Weber.
The fifth Sunday of Lent has us considering one of Jesus's somewhat hard to understand parables about tenant farmers who, from some fantastic, mind-numbing, and willed dumbness, came to the conclusion that if they murder the vineyard's heir, they would gain possession of the vineyard. Now, there is no law in any land that awards property to the people who successfully kill the heirs of that, of the property. But yet in their mind, they thought that by murdering the heir, they would gain possession of the vineyard. Now, this is nonsense on stilts, but it was plausible to them because they lived under an illusion that they owned the vineyard. That the vineyard, in some sense, was theirs to do with as they pleased. Now, of course, when we're talking about this fictitional vineyard, it looks absurd. But Jesus is making the point that if all the world is a creation, then everything that has been given to everything that we call ours is actually has been given to us. And so the parable is an example of how deceptive the magic word mine is. Saying mine conveniently forgets that God has created everything, has given everything to us to do with as he pleases, not as we please. The delusion in the word mine conveniently forgets that death awaits everything that lives, and that makes all of our possessions impermanent. The only true sense that we can say that something is mine is like a library book, which is mine. I have possession of it, but the possession is temporary. And in time, the book, while I have it, I need to take care of it, but it's going to have to be returned. That's what the word mine, the only meaning that it can make sense of in this world. We live our lives in the shadow of death, which means mine is not mine for long. And with all lives, the tenant farmers recognized that they could only sustain this lie using violence. And then when Jesus, trying to drive home the point of the parable to his audience, when he asked those who Luke says sought to lay their hands on him, when he asked those who were intending to kill him what they thought of the tenant farmers, they all agreed that the owner should come and destroy those tenant farmers and give the vineyard to others. But they did not see that the parable was directed at their own possessiveness, because they too were under the spell of the possessive pronoun mine. And to break their delusion, Jesus alerted them that, yes, they would succeed in their plan to kill him, but the outcome of his death would be something that they never could have planned and did not control. The cross did not end Christ's claim on his creation. No, Jesus said the cross would lay the cornerstone, that he would be the cornerstone that would begin the expansion into eternity of the new creation. In fact, with the cross, the owner of the vineyard would not destroy the vineyard. In fact, he had come to save it. Now, Psalm 126 takes us into a a bit of a different direction, where it says, our mouths were filled with laughter. It seems odd that this psalm would introduce laughter into Lent. And the context was when Israel experienced what was considered a miraculous restoration from exile. That truth seemed like a good dream that had become real. Or the other analogy is that this restoration, this unexpected restoration, was like the explosion of growth that takes place in the barren Negev desert whenever the rare rains ignite the dormant vegetation that lies buried in the lifeless sand. See, when we experience these unexpected incongruities, when the good dream turns out to be real, we express ourselves in laughter because laughter expresses the depth of joy that escapes language. Lent is not funny. The crucifixion is not humorous. But yet, it is what gives our laughter depth. Christ's sacrificial suffering and death and his descent into hell are the depths that work like the desert or like the exile, that when the depths are overcome, they produce a lightness, the heights of joy. And we express in laughter this lightness of the heart that has suffered the depths and emerge from that experience to the fullness of life. Lent is not humorous, but it is a necessary foundation for humor and happiness. So the psalm introduces laughter into our contemplation of Lent, and it's appropriate because it is a prophetic anticipation of the reversal that Christ would effect in his resurrection. Now, Isaiah takes this unanticipated happiness in talking about the brilliance that there is water in the desert and that God's salvation is a new thing. But this new thing works like a very old thing, that in order to survive the desert, there needs to be water. The desert is utterly death unless you can find water. And so God's new thing that Isaiah announces is actually the rescue of the old creation, of rescuing all of the goodness. And this rescue is going to be like rivers in the wasteland. Isaiah is impressed with the idea that a wasteland can have rivers. He wants us to recognize that what makes for rejoicing is that it has, in the desert where we do not expect our thirst to be quenched, that real rejoicing takes place when our thirst is quenched by this water. When our thirst is quenched, we are participating in God's new thing, which is both a participation that requires a suffering thirst, and it requires that thirst be quenched. That's what this salvation is. It's not a salvation from the desert. It is actually within the context of the desert, within the context of death, that we are lifted out by the gifts that God provides. See, when we take a simple sip of water that quenches our thirst, we are participating in the depth and mysteries of God's salvation. What seems like a mundane act that happens all the time with us, we get thirsty, we quench the thirst, is in fact treated by Isaiah as a fearful cemetery where we have need that is perfectly satisfied by God's gift. This is the world of salvation, that our desires are on the path to being perfectly satisfied and eternally satisfied. The cemetery is fearful because the created world has lost that symmetry, and it's sad. The created world, we have, in the created world, the fallen world, we have desires that are not satisfied. We have loneliness that is left begging. We have cruelty that is not stopped. But in the new thing that God is doing, living in this new world, there is no promise that goes without satisfaction. See, when God announces this new thing of restoration, he's promising that what we desired in the first thing of creation will actually be fulfilled by his intervention. If God is doing this new thing, then every experience now of our thirst being quenched is a foretaste of an eternal satisfaction of never-ending life. No longer is the world defined by deprivation. This is what's so fearful about this cemetery, that there is deprivation all around us, but that is only the first step to satisfaction. It is the depths that give rise to our laughter. That's what deprivation means from now on because of salvation. Deprivation is the first stage in life's movement to satisfaction. So both our thirst and the satisfaction that water gives acclaims God's goodness, first given in creation and then rescued in salvation. Now, I want to say a little something about this acclamation. It's interesting that in the ritual of the Old Testament and New Testament, the assembly would acclaim God antiphonally. In other words, a cantor would sing a verse and the congregation would respond. And this is a ritual way in order to talk about this fearful symmetry. That there is a thirsty deprivation, which is the cantor singing, and then that is met with the satisfaction that the congregation responds. And this antiphonal universe where there is a call and a response, that is the universe that Isaiah sees being proclaimed and enjoyed every time we suffer thirst and it is satisfied with God's gift of water. That is an image of salvation. Now, with Philippians, Paul spells out what it means to be living in that, in the light of that salvation. In other words, Paul says what salvation means is that Christ's righteousness is going to make righteous everything that is wrong in the world. And that righteousness was fully manifested in his resurrection. So in other words, the resurrection has already happened. Christ's righteousness has already, the cornerstone of that project has already been laid down. And Christ is now, even now, making all that is wrong to become right. He's turning the upside down world upright. And this promise, Paul wants to work out what it actually means for us who are in the old world, but with the promise of the emerging new world. This writing of all that is wrong is going to begin its work from the inside out. It begins with faith in the single individual's heart, soul, and mind. Paul is keen on that if we want to really see the glory of Christ's righteousness, we don't look outside ourselves. We look into what faith is doing in restoring our heart, soul, and mind. And Paul's restoration, this restoration of faith working from the inside, Paul experiences it most is when he experienced loss. Now, we may think that loss is the depths that destroy faith, when in fact Paul sees that loss is the first step that defeats all of despair. The cross manifested a loss that led to the resurrection, that there is loss because God is using that loss in order to advance the righteousness that will be forever. So Paul thinks that this righteousness is not just something that we cash in at the end of our lives. It's not just a doctrine. Christ's righteousness is existentially explosive. It's Christ's righteousness. It's Christ's assurance that all that is wrong is going to be set right. Is that gave Paul the power to reckon. Several times this word is used. The word reckon means to recognize. And Paul says the power of the resurrection allows me to recognize in loss that all losses are a gift that reveal Christ's intention to satisfy our desires, and that for all that is wrong to be set right. So Paul says within him, what faith allows him to do is to experience events, but to recognize the importance of those events very differently. So that we don't miss the joy that is in these experiences of loss, Paul repeats the truth of Christ's righteousness, liberating him to recognize, there's the word again, in the same verse, everything in the world is no better than rubbish. Now that sounds like a diminishment of the world. But in fact, what Paul is saying is when we see, when we imagine, when we come to grips with the righteousness that Christ is working with this goodness, every other goodness on this earth is just a shoddy shadow of that perfection. What Christ's righteousness has allowed Paul to do is to desire the perfection in his heart because he recognizes that that perfection will be satisfied by Christ's righteousness. And once perfection is considered a real promise, it's just impossible to be content with possessing stuff that is just aspiring rubbish. Just give it enough time and all that is good will become rubbish. That's why it can be nothing more than a foretaste, nothing more than a reminder of what Christ's righteousness is accomplishing. When loss reminds us that the world's future lies in a cosmic rubbish bin, then the promise of Christ's righteousness it can go to work within us. And Paul says what this does is it allows him to see, to forget all that has been lost. See what this righteousness does, that faith in this righteousness allows Paul to be forgetful. That loss is not what the world's about. That's a thing of the past. The new thing that God is doing has to lift us out of this loss. And Paul says that freed him to persecute. He actually uses the word to persecute the promise of perfection that was sealed by Christ's resurrection.
Thank you, David, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Go to the App Store or Google Play and get the one that is right for you for free. If you have any questions or comments about our program or any other programs on our schedule, write me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. David and I will be back next week at this same time. Stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.